That's all I have to say.
First, some housekeeping. First, let's go through this list that Jay has just handed out and see that it's accurate. I'm sure it is, but let's be sure. Let's see what we have. Some may take it as attendance.
Like me.
Really? Okay, Dan Zeller. Robert Zeller?
Yes.
Yes. Carol Billy?
Yes.
Yes. Saul Barodkin?
No.
Harry Bornstein? Very good. Barry Culler?
Do you have a Delaney card?
Next time, Jay, you'll be on the top of that, please. Bobby Culler. Lucas Tinia. Lucas.
That's the young man he's not here.
Ron Eisenberg. Yeah. Mayor Epstein is not here. Francis Friedman.
Here.
Henry Glanderty.
Yeah.
Ira Glauber. See. Nori Hollander. Terry Kowich. Who?
Second half
of the year?
Yes.
Owen Lewis. Right here tonight. Mark Lowenstein.
Yes.
Yeah. Ben Marcus.
Yes.
Alan Mayer.
Where
is he? There he is. Robert Alden. Excellent. Jay Palmer.
Here.
Carol Rappin.
Here.
Great. Laura Resnikoff. Yeah. Elaine Shatner. Reed Schneider. Herb Shapiro. Peter Salagi.
Yeah.
What?
Salagi.
Salagi Spellbank?
Yeah.
Okay. They think you're Hungarian. I don't know why they have that idea. Got an American boy like that. Okay. Michelle Trachtenberg. Miriam Wallerstein. Arya Weiss. Milt Wolfson. Barry Yud. Nora Yud. Fatigue tonight. Okay. Okay, that was number one. Great. Anybody that I didn't call?
Vic
Stadium. Vic Stadium. So we cross off Dory? Okay, and put Vic. Okay, very good. That's why it's good to check these things out. Now, number two. Next week there will be no class. There will be no class next week. I will be away, and so you could be, but I won't be here. Now, did you want to also talk about Hanukkah, you're saying?
It's comfortable thing that we would have our
party. We had traditionally had a Hanukkah party. Let's see when Hanukkah is.
We will have a wine party. Yep. It will be
December 5th.
Okay, so our next class is going to be our next week is the 21st, so our next class will be the 28th of November. The week after that is December 5th, which will be the second night of Hanukkah. And we will have our class then, and we will have our traditional lighting of the Hanukkiah, followed at the end of the class by some joyful refreshments.
For those of you who haven't come before, we'll just quickly explain. We ordered this huge halva, and we have drinks, and that's our menu, which has now become a tradition. So if everyone chips in $10, we cover expenses tonight.
The halva only costs
$10. You like to make a profit. You know, I like to make a profit.
How much is that?
Over here, I was in Milan. Jay and Dick Staden emailed me desperately. What's the phone number for the halva man?
So how much does the halva cost? It's expensive?
$70.
Wow. That's a lot of money.
So we're going to our
party. It's as they say in these parts, it's a tradition. Okay. Ladies and gentlemen, we are on Daf Gimel Amud Aleph, 3A. Following in English, it is 3A1. The very last line of that page. We are finished with the subject of Dirachim, the three ways. Remember, we saw Derech, and why is it Derech, and why is it not Davar? We brought in nature, and then we finally came to the conclusion as well that a Davar was for something that is singular, and Dirachim are where there is more than one, for what it's worth. Now, we had seen that in the Mishnah that there are three methods that can be used for Kiddushim, right? Kesef, Shtar, and Biyah. Now, it is always the case in the Gemara, or nearly always the case in the Gemara, that if the Gemara will give you three ways, there are actually two ways it could have done it. There are two ways to give three ways. One way to give three ways is to give the three ways. The other way to give the three ways is to say there are three ways. These are what they are. Do you see the difference? Way number one was, these are the ways to perform Kiddushin. Kesef, Shtar, and Dina. Right? Those are the three. And without saying there are three of them, but just giving them to us. Other way to do it is to say there are three of them, and these are what they are. Okay? The general principle used in the hermeneutics of the Torah is that words are not wasted. If there are superfluous words, they are there for a reason. Similarly, in the legal documents, if a document is so constructed, the assumption is that in all likelihood it is constructed thoughtfully. Rabbi Judah the Prince edited the Mishnah. He knew what he was doing when he edited it. And if he created redundancies in the text, and there in fact was an easier way to state the subject, then there must be a reason for the redundancies that he created in the text. It's all how to read the written law. All right, how do you even read the written form of the oral law, which in fact is what we're dealing with here when we're reading the Mishnah. Okay? So, the problem that the Gemara will now entertain is, why do we have the number three? We have already looked at why do we have the Rahim. Shalosh Drachim. Now the question is, what do we need the Shalosh for? Right? Why do we need to know the number three? Right? So here we are, over onto the next page. Minyana Dereisha Lima Utimai. If you have a specific number in the first part of the Mishnah, Lima Utimai Lima Eitma. That is to say, to exclude what? If you have three, and then you have the three, well, implied in that must be that there was something else that could have been that they didn't include. And that's the force of saying the number three in addition to telling us what the three things are. Okay? There probably was a fourth. There may be even a fifth. And by saying that there are shalosh drachim, that is like saying there are shalosh drachim. Now, if you said that, you would assume that there were probably other things that people were thinking about, but the teacher finally came to emphasize only three, and not what you're thinking. But the question is, well, what were you thinking? What were the alternatives? Okay, so here the first part, it says, Minyana Deresh, the number in the first part of the Mishnah, that is to say that there are three ways to make Kiddushin. What does that come to exclude? The Ma'utemai? And then it goes on. Minyana Deresh, the truth is that in the Mishnah, the second half of the Mishnah also has a number. It says, and there are two ways for the woman to gain her freedom. So what do I need two for? Right? It could have just told me what they were. Similarly, limit within mind, to exclude what? So you see what the reasoning is? This is the logic of reading the construction of a legal text. Minyana deresh lema'ute chuta. Oh, first the Gemara comes and says that the reason why you have the number three is that in fact you are trying to exclude something. And that exclusion is chuta. Chuta. And remember that we have read Kesef Shtarim Bia. And most of you will think when you come to a wedding, the obvious thing that you come to is the chuppah, to have a chuppah. But remember back that the chuppah really used to be separated from the kiddushin. Kiddushin was year one. Chuppah could have been as long after as year two. So it could have been, though, that you could have put them both of them fairly closely together. It could have been that you might have thought that the chuppah could also serve as a shortcut, and that you wouldn't in fact need these other things. If the chuppah was such an obvious part of the whole transaction, and everybody knows that a Jewish wedding involves the chuppah, so the Gemara says, "Lema'ute mai," to exclude what? It excludes chuppah as a form of kiddushin. Namely, the chuppah is something different. You can't just have a chuppah. You have to have these other things, because they, in fact, make the contract. The chuppah then becomes symbolic of the second stage of the marriage, which is that she symbolically enters into his household, and then they live together as husband and wife. Right? So those are two different things. In the year one after the kiddushin, if they wanted to separate, they would need a get. So they were sort of married. If they wanted to go home and live together, they would shoot them. I'm exaggerating. You're not allowed to do that. It's not nice. So the chuppah is different. And the chuppah does not serve as a substitute for the kiddushin, or cannot be included as kiddushin, is one of the possibilities. Okay? So here, Ula Rav Huna, now the Gemara says, but Rav Huna, as we will learn later on, Rav Huna says, Yamar Chuppah Kona. I just told you that Chuppah is not a form of kiddushin. Well, that's true for everybody except Rav Huna. Rav Huna, in fact, says that Chuppah is a form of kiddushin. It's not a preferred form of kiddushin. But if you don't have any of the other forms, and you just have the chuppah, from when you said, that's okay. So, the Mishnah, Rav Huna, comes after the time of the Mishnah. Rav Huna is a Babylonian Amorah. The Mishnah is edited in the year 200. Okay? So obviously, according to Rav Huna, he must have also agreed that the Mishnah excludes something. And if, according to Rav Huna, it doesn't exclude chuppah, because chuppah is also a valid form of kiddushin, then what would Rav Huna say? What else could it exclude? It's got to exclude something. The answer is, Rav Huna di amar chuppah kona mikal v'chomer. That's just a summary of what we will read later on. Rav Huna believes that chuppah is a valid means of kiddushin, and he develops his argument on the basis of a kal v'chomer. Kal v'chomer, which we'll see several times tonight, kal v'chomer is where you have one situation which is simple, but obvious, and then you have a second situation where it's either less or more obvious. Okay, so we say if it's true in case A, well, how much more so must it be true in case B? we'll have to prove this Kal Vachomer when we see it, but that's the form of argument, and that's what later on Rav Huna will be doing to prove that Chuppah is also a valid form of Kiddushin. So, but what he said, Lema Utimai, what does the number three come to exclude according to Rav Huna? Here the Gemara says, Lema Ute Chalitin. It comes to exclude Chalitin. Chalitin. Now, Chalitin is a very interesting word. Well, let's just go, we'll go to the end of that paragraph. Sal kadata chanina hu'il v'gamar kicha kicha mistei aflahom. Lest you would have thought that the fact that we learned from two words, kicha kicha, from the story about the field of Ephraim the Hittite, Masadeh Niknaya Bechalitin, just as a field can be purchased with Chalitin, Af Ishanami Niknaya Bechalitin, also a woman can be acquired with Chalitin. Kamash Malan, therefore the Mishnah comes and teaches us the number three in order to exclude the possibility that this transaction can take place with Chalitin. Alright, what is Chalitin? Let's take a look at Rashi. We haven't been looking much at Rashi, so let's look at Rashi. Rashi is now, Rashi, remember, is always on the inside piece of the page, next to the margin. And if you go down, you'll see that we have two things that are on the Gemara. One is the Rashi, the inside here, and the other is the Tosafot on the outside. The Tosafot on this particular page are very big. So in fact, after they finish the Rashi, the Tosafot also goes out to the inside, because there's just so many Tosafot. It's very full in Tosafot on this particular page. So the Rashi is now 1, 2, 3, 4 lines from the bottom of the Rashi. It says Chalitin, or Chalitin. Chalitin. Kinyan Sudar. Chalitin means acquisition with a handkerchief. Acquisition with a handkerchief. Now, in Jewish law, there are a variety of forms of acquisition, some of which we have seen. And one of the things that we will learn in this chapter, because for the conditions of marriage we are bringing up certain forms of acquisition, we will see other forms of acquisition discussed as well. And from time to time the question will be, can you use those in order to consecrate a marriage? That's because we see that this is structured out of the forms of used in trade. Why? Because we read or saw at the very beginning that there were two uses of the verb kicha, kuf yod chet, or lakacha, to take. One of them was, when he shall take a woman to be his wife, ki yikach ish isha. The other one was from the story of Abraham buying the land for the Maraka Machpelah, the cave of the Machpelah. And he says to Ephron the Hittite, this money, kach mineni, take it from me. Okay? So we learn in two places. What is the activity, in fact, of taking a wife? We can learn what that activity is from the other use of kichal, which is in the story about Ephraim the Hittite. There was the passage of money from one hand to another. Okay? So that's what we learn. However, there are a variety of forms and ways that you can buy land. And the commercial transactions that apply to objects in Jewish law are different than the way in which you complete a transaction for the purchase of land. I suspect that's probably true in most legal systems. In American law, is that true? Yes?
No.
Okay, so when you buy an object, there are ways that you can complete that sale. And when you buy something that is land or like land, there may be a few other things that are considered like land. I don't know, is a house land or is a house not land?
Mm-hmm.
House is land?
requires a written document for personal property to be conveyed in tablets.
Fascinating. Same thing in Jewish law. Same thing in Jewish law. Although you have this additional form, which is part of the way that real property can be transferred, which is called Kinyan Sudar. Kinyan Sudar is where you take a handkerchief.
And I make you my agent for selling my
company. That's one of the ways that we use Kinyan Sudar. Take a handkerchief. I hold on one side of the handkerchief. You hold on to the other side of the handkerchief. Okay? And you pull toward you, and I pull toward me. That makes a valid transaction. That makes a valid transaction.
That is property
or real property, and could be other kinds of property too. All right? Does it? Yes, it has to be witnessed. Yep. Yep. All commercial transactions have to be witnessed. Not Hasidic. Jewish. Oh, no, that's different. That's different. That's different. Because there's no transaction going on there. Because all that's happening is they're not touching. The idea there is they're not touching. So, but our custom that we use is when you sell the chametz and you empower me to be the person, the shaliach, the agent, to sell the chametz, I carry around, I usually make the transaction with a pen. And I'll hold out the pen, you pull the pen from one side, I pull the pen from the other side, and that's the way to make a valid kinyan. Now there are other ways to make the kinyan, but that's the most traditional way to make that acquisition. Okay? Now, you'll notice that, let's go back to the theory of kinyan sudar. The theory of Kinyan Sudar is actually its barter. It goes back to a transaction based on barter. And that's what Chalitin literally means. Lachlos in Hebrew is to change. Lachlis. It's to change. And it really symbolizes a barter transaction. It's a real barter. And when you do this, what it eventually turned into was that I have the handkerchief because I'm sort of conducting this whole thing. But in theory, what's happening is that I'm giving you a free gift of my handkerchief. Right? I'm giving you a gift of the handkerchief. That therefore, is your handkerchief. You're going to give me the handkerchief back because now it's yours. You're going to give it to me. And then I'm going to give you the field. Or I'm going to give you the ketubah. It's the same thing for signing a ketubah. Before we sign the ketubah, we also have to make a kinyan. We do a kinyan sudar. The same thing. What is it like in our legal system? It's really most like a handshake. Trust. Closest to a handshake. Closest to trust. Because it is something that is, in fact, entirely symbolic. Entirely symbolic. Here, I've just said to you, I'm giving you something, and you're giving it back to me. It's obviously a completely symbolic activity. And as far as the law is concerned, the law of Chalitin is that whatever the object is that is transferred between us can have no value at all. It can have no value at all. Remember when we set up the laws of Kiddushin, there was a machloket, a dispute between Beit Shammai and Beit Hillel. Beit Shammai says that when you make the kiddushin for money, it has to be dinar of a shaveh dinar. It has to be a lot of money. Gold. Real stuff. Beit Hillel says, puta of a shaveh puta. Not a penny or anything worth a penny. Kinyan Sudar can be worth less than a penny. Can be worth less than a penny. It's an entirely symbolic action.
Can be or must be.
Can be. Doesn't necessarily must be, but it can be. Can be. Okay? Who has the handkerchief at the end? I have a bank. I have a bank because I am giving you, I really am the one who I'm going to give you something. So I'm the one who's eventually going to get it back. You're going to give it to me, as it were, as if payment, or you're going to make a barter transaction with me. You're going to give me the handkerchief. I'm going to give you whatever I have, and it's a done deal. Okay? So I think it's closest in its symbolic nature to our idea of the handshake. Okay? In many a business, a handshake is a crucial event. I know people tell me that that's hard as in the diamond business. You shake somebody's hand. You say mazel bracha in the diamond business. It's a transaction. And you will have no livelihood. I mean, this is not the mafia. I don't know how they work, but in the diamond business, as I understand it, from we've had colleagues who have told me this, that if you go against your word, you'll simply nobody will ever deal with you again. You are out. You are absolutely out of the business at that point. So that your word and the symbolic activity that is recognized in the community of people who do such transactions, the symbol is worthy of the word is crucial, and there's absolutely no way to undo it. Okay? Not much, not much, not in my business. They tell me that that is a very on-the-up business. And anybody who fools around, they kick them out in a second, it loses the livelihood.
Diamond Club is one of the major diamond buildings.
Only one.
And they have, I guess you have to go a restaurant, but in the Diamond Club, they have photographs and listings of all the people who have been eggs on agreement.
May none of you ever be on that list. We had a congregant who was one of the founders of this diamond club. He joined us. He was here for about a year, and unfortunately, he died. Somewhere in this library is a book that he wrote about coming from Belgium and with his father, and the efforts then to create a diamond business here in New York, and the assumption sort of what they had to do to create that, and then the level of honesty and morality in the business, which he just felt was so, he was very proud of that. This was their creation, and this is something that is absolutely sacrosanct. How do you know?
He says that he also feels very anxious before people could write. They couldn't.
Uh-huh.
So this kind of equal effort, mm-hmm. So it feels to me, I don't know if it's true, but it feels like it goes back before
they actually signed up. Mm-hmm. Possible, but just think the other methods that we've mentioned, the other methods sometimes are usable. One is paying cash. Mm-hmm. Okay, so the activity of a payment also doesn't require any kind of a document. And in fact, that in some transactions, as you were saying before, Milton, were you saying that the money doesn't make a transaction for land?
Right, it must be in writing.
It has to be in writing. So the transfer of money isn't crucial, whereas if you go to, I assume, Tiffany's, when you pay your money, I assume you get your goods. I assume that that's true, but I'm not absolutely sure whether that's true. Do any of you know whether that's true?
True.
True? True. The only
that's
time...
they care about.
No, that's a good point. That is one of the reasons why money is not a valid means of transferring property. Because one of the definitions of the ownership of property in theory is that you own the property. You could do whatever you want, including destroy the property. although there are strictures on that in Jewish law. There is land you can't destroy. It's not destroyable. No way to destroy land. You could lower its value, maybe, but you really can't destroy it. Or at least I think you can't destroy it. And maybe that's because of the divine ownership of the land, that is part of the nature of the commodity. So therefore, the means of transfer is going to be different means of transfer.
Earlier, the woman had accepting
the money,
not her father doing so, or her mother. So here, I mean, the woman has participated in these exchanges?
Oh, yeah. A woman could...
This isn't the limitation
in
that regard.
No, a woman could do the same. A woman is perfectly permitted to engage in transactions of all property, real or movable property. So it would not be for that. Well, that's going to leave us still questioning, of course. The implicit question here is, what's wrong with barter? We have a method here of chalipin, which in fact is used in the transactions of real property, and to force the issue, the very example we used in order to prove that kicha kicha meant a transaction of money was a transaction that was drawn from Ephron the Hittite. When Abraham has a transaction with Ephron the Hittite, that transaction is a real property transaction. Okay? And here we are saying that the thing excluded in Kiddushin is Chalitin, which is for a real property transaction. It seems, in fact, illogical. That of all things should be the thing that you use, because that's what Ephron the Hittite and Abraham used. I thought it's really odd that you should exclude that.
But in the original discussion in the Mishnah, both Elohim and Shammai said Keseth means Keseth, whatever, or something equal in value. So in a sense, they're saying something equal in value means not Keseth. So it's boring, really.
Correct, but the key issue here is going to be something of lesser value than the minimal kesef. That's the real issue. Because something of more value would already fall into the kesef category. Okay? So the real issue is, can it be a totally symbolic action as opposed to being an action of transferring something of value?
Okay?
Why? The question is, how do we know that they're married? That's the question. Whether they're helping or not, that's another question. Hopefully, you know, that's an independent question. But it's important for society to know whether there's a marriage there. Okay? For a variety of reasons. For a wide variety of reasons.
Is it right?
Wait. Yes.
Sorry. Yes. Coming back to marriage. What sort of marriage, if ceremony, if any, would apply if you acquired the womanhood of the enemies you killed in the battle?
Too far afield. Too far afield. Let's stick with it. Okay? Yes.
Where do they have a system of keeping records of a marriage and settlement?
Mm-hmm. The answer is yes and no. Yes and no. Because if things have to be witnessed and the nature of the transaction is a transaction that is the passage of money from the hands of one person to another person, nothing that I have just said involves writing it down. And therefore, there is a certain assumption that there may be no records. And that the only real way to check is to find the witnesses. Okay? And there are obvious limits to that. So you can understand why at a certain point, but not at an early point. Because keep in mind that in early times, they didn't have any paper. Now, so much of what we take for granted presupposes the ready availability of paper and the ability to write things down. there come to be certain things, in fact, are recorded. A get is recorded.
On stone.
A get is recorded not on stone, but on paper. A get has to be recorded on paper. So there are some things that have to be recorded. Not the kiddushin. Kiddushin does not have to be recorded. It has to be witnessed, but not recorded. It may be recorded because we know that that's one of the three ways. Shtar. But the other two ways do not involve recording it, although they do involve witnesses. Yes.
If Rav Kuhnin is saying that he believes that Kuba is part of tradition, wouldn't you then have four elements of tradition?
Right. Well, yes. But what? Well, four. For Rav Kuhnin, you're quite right. He would. Just going like that, we now have four. So the way he would deal with that is, well, there are three, but there is a fourth which in emergency is okay. So in other words, if we do have three, there is a fourth that we can develop by virtue of logic. Sometimes you can extend the law because of logic. Logic will say, well, if this is true, surely that would be true. That's why it says kal vachomer there. Not that he has a source for it, but he has a logical argument for it.
But that really does contradict the language of the Mishnah.
Well, that's not accepted. You're right. It's not accepted. But what the rabbis will do, since you do have a point of view like this, and you do have the possibility of extending the law based on logic, because the law can develop beyond where it is at a particular point. He is, again, as I said before, after Rabbi Judah the Prince. So he might want to extend the law by developing it logically. Very possible. What we do learn, even in that case, is that there is another excluded possibility. And that excluded possibility is Chalitin, barter. Now the Gemara says, right? Kamash Malan, it must be that butter is not included. And that is what is excluded by saying the number three. So then the Gemara says, Ve'emachinami. Maybe butter should be excluded. What's wrong with butter? You said it should be excluded. Why should it be excluded? That's a good idea. It's a good idea to include it. Alright? Chalipin itnahu. And here's the answer. It is possible for chalifin to exist at a value of less than a pruta. The isha befachot misha bepruta, but a woman at less than the value of a pruta, lo maknaya nasha. She will not sell herself. In other words, how could you have the chutzpah to enter into a transaction where the thing itself doesn't have any value? It's simply not nice. It's not nice. Okay? Now let's look at some of the commentary here. First of all, let's look at Rashi. Masa de miknaya bechalifin, as a field can be acquired with barter, and here the allusion is to the book of Ruth in the fourth chapter, vayishlof na'alo. This is a field that is acquired, and it says, and he took off his shoe. That's a form of chalifin. A shoe can be used as chalitin. I just told you I was using my pen as chalitin. Or we're using a handkerchief as chalitin. You could use a shoe as chalitin. And that's what we see is used, in fact, in the purchase of the field in the book of Ruth. Okay? Right, let's throw in a Rashi. The hatam sadehave. And there in the book of Ruth, the purchase was of a field. Chalitin itanhu b'fachot mishabepruta'ah. It is possible to have a barter transaction with something that is worth less than a pruta. The kaimalan b'terach hazahav, because we learn in the chapter which begins hazahav in Baba Metzia, Konin bichli afal pisha eno shave pruta. One is able to acquire real property even though the object that is used in the transaction has less value than a pruta, less value than a penny. Okay? All right, I want to go a little bit further. Lo miknayim nafsha cannot acquire herself, or she cannot be acquired by something less than a pruta. And look at Rashi. Dignai hula. It is contemptuous of her. It is contemptuous of her. Hilkach batya la litarat chalipin bekidushin. Therefore, the idea of using something which has no value is annulled, is discounted as a possible way of making kiddushin. Okay? So that was the issue, really, which was implicit in Shammai and Hillel, was the fact that whatever is involved in a transaction has to have value. Because the other side of the transaction, the one who is receiving it, in a sense, really treats this as a gift. As a gift. And the gift, in fact, is the model. It has to be something of value. And if you were to give a gift that had no value at all, then that conveys a certain low level of thought about the one to whom you are giving something. Okay? Here, the English is a nice. Lo miknayim will not give herself over, for such an exchange would be demeaning to her. Hence, the method of chalifin becomes invalid for kiddushin, regardless of the actual value of the item exchanged, and the Mishnah's exclusion of this method is therefore justified. Okay? No, doesn't have to be any. In theory, you could just. You could do it, for example, in a family. You would have a change of ownership. You could want to keep certain things within the family, and yet change the ownership from father to son. Okay? And have no money change hands at all. And how would you make that happen? You make that happen by one of the means of acquisition. You still have to go through some procedure to cause that transfer to take place.
So the meaning aspect of the media conference is, I'd rather be purchased for something of no value, have it be on the syllabus involved, than have somebody buy it for a penny.
Ask your wife and see what she does. I think that what we are seeing here really is that there are models, and I used the term before of models. And I think that one model is the model of simply the symbolic transfer. The other model is that there is some side to the transfer which conveys something of the notion of a gift. Okay? Some side. It's not a central side to it, because we saw that from Shammai's point of view, yes, that could be argued, because it was something really of significant value. Hillel was willing to say, no, I have a compromised position. It can be something of small value, but not something of no value. So that you maintain, as a way, the symbolic nature of two things here. One is that it is something that is symbolic, and that's all that matters. On the other hand, it is also, to some extent, a gift, because it is not something that has no value at all. I say there's a compromise.
Anyway, didn't you just say that chalitza is a form of chalitza?
Chalitza, no.
No?
I didn't mention chalitza. So that's
I
coming
mean,
right.
With the show.
That's not chalitza. That's not chalitza. I mean, that could be chalitza if you were performing an act of chalitza.
No.
But you could also take off your shoe if you wanted to come here, Erev Pesach, and show me and give me.
Oh, you weren't referring to.
No, there's no referring to chalitza at all. This is totally different. You wanted to come in to the Yisium the day before Pesach. You want to give me the authorization to sell your chametz, to take off your shoe. You say, here, come in. You pull on one side of the shoe, I'll pull on the other side of the shoe. We do it, it's a deal.
But wasn't Ruth and Boaz a form of chalitza?
Not in this context.
No.
Not in that context.
What happens in the modern marriage ceremony of chalitza?
You don't have chalitza. You can't have chalitza. Remember that. Chalitza is not a valid form of kiddushin. Only three forms of kiddushin: Pesach, Shtar, and Bia. And in the modern marriage ceremony, we have each of those. We have Kesef with a ring. We have Shtar. We have a certificate. We have Bia. We have Yichud after the ceremony. Okay? But we have no Chalitza. Because that is not a permissible form of tradition. Yes?
Your tradition was changed to Chalitza, and earlier they used the same case of Abraham's acquisition of the Barak HaMakhtalah, Kicha Kicha argument. So you can acquire property through Chalitza, real property, and there's an analogy between the acquisition of real property and acquisition Kiddushin because of the use of the same term, so logically you should be able
to. You're saying what the Gemara said, right? You're right. So you're right, which will lead the Gemara in about another half a page to try and find another source for the source of Kesef. It still may be that this is a good source. It still may be that in this circumstance it's a source that's, you know, 50% usable or 70% usable. The idea is a good idea. There's a lot of the ways that you transfer property are not totally different. Some of the methods of transfer are the same. Okay? So it's not as if these are two completely exclusive areas. But the point that you're making is a good point. And because of that, the Gemara is going to have to entertain whether there are any other possibilities for proving the centrality of Kesef as a form of Kiddushin. Okay?
Does this mean we're seeing an argument like, you know, the balance?
Yeah, it this doesn't have any impact on whether Rav Huna is right or wrong. It is simply saying that there are, now we know, two things that are excluded, according to the rabbis. One thing they already said is excluded from Kiddushin is Chuppah. The other thing that is excluded from Kiddushin is Chalitzin. So according to the rabbis, there are two things that are excluded when we say the number three. According to Rav Huna, there is one thing that is excluded when we say the number three. Okay? But as a result of this argument, we have no idea whether Rav Huna is right or wrong. That we have not commented on. Okay? Yeah.
In Borough Park, Brooklyn, there are a couple of mortgage companies run by Black Hat Jews, and they still have the symbolic gesture of the handkerchief, and then they give a dollar.
Mm-hmm.
However, if you deal with these mortgage companies, I would suggest you get a bank check.
Mm-hmm.
But they actually still mm-hmm. have the practice of the handkerchief.
Interesting.
Yeah.
But, well, there's a general principle of Jewish law which is not necessarily followed by everybody, because I can see a room for this also. We have a principle in Jewish law that dina de malchuta dina, that the law of the land is the law. And that applies particularly in all areas of commercial transactions. So that, in fact, commercial transactions in America have to be done according to American law, even according to Jewish law. Even according to Jewish law.
Truly.
Yes. Right. However, if that doesn't stop people from doing things however they want to do it. And I don't know, I assume American law would accept all kinds of odd ways to make a transaction simply as forms that people have where they make private agreements. And I don't know the extent to which these things are admissible or not admissible in an American court, but it could be that these people, part of what is being said here is that they have no intention, if it would ever be challenged, of bringing it into an American court. That in a way the whole system of courts is something that they're trying to avoid, and in fact it becomes an arbitration. In a way, anything can be an arbitration, as long as the two parties agree to certain ground rules. And that's what's being assumed, and I assume that kind of an argument. Yes.
I don't think we're going to say that the number comes to exclude Charlie's hand, because that's excluded by the argument that the woman won't give herself over to something of no value.
No, not necessarily. No, that is giving us the reason why we exclude it. Now, we're trying to find out what the reason is. Okay?
But the implication is that both co found colleagues in sometimes were practiced, which is why they're not discussing it, yes?
They were practiced, but not necessarily ever practiced for this purpose, for the purpose of Kiddushin. Yes, Chuppah is a little bit different, because Chuppah is unique. It's unique to the wedding ceremony. Chalifin is not at all unique, and Chalifin is forced by the very scriptural citation that we had of the field of Ephron the Hittite. So that's natural to bring into the argument, I think.
Can we find out why Chuppah is not accepted?
If you stick around, yeah. That comes up later. Yeah. Which is the Kiddushin. That's Kesef. That's Kesef. So that's perfectly kosher. Okay? Remember that form number one is Kesef. And what I said just in passing and rather quickly, keep in mind that our custom of the ring doesn't have to be a ring. You could use money. There are places where Jews actually use money rather than a ring. I don't know when the custom of the ring grew up. It surely is not in the Talmud. Talmud never mentions the presence of a ring. I know as a young rabbi, I was taught that there are lots of reasons why we have rings, that the ring has to be complete because it can't have any openings in it, because it symbolizes the fullness and the wholeness of everything. Well, all that's very nice, but it's not true. The only thing that's true is that it has to be something that's of recognizable value. That's true. So that if you have a ring that has all kinds of stuff in it, then that's not what we want for a ring that's a kosher a ring for Kesef. We don't know how much it's worth. It's something that's used in this transaction, as it were, got to have a comprehensible value, something that both parties know what the value is. That's why we use gold. The reason for the use of gold is that gold is a universal standard. Questions come up in Jewish law whether platinum is permissible. Platinum, in fact, is permissible. But it's a rather recent development. But gold is a formal standard. The alternative always was an issue, and a major issue a few years ago, still is a big issue in weddings, is the use of stones in wedding bands. Generally speaking, most rabbis will tell you you're not allowed to have a stone on your wedding band. That when you buy a wedding band, make sure that it's a simple wedding band and no stone on it. Why? Because you don't know how much the value of a stone is. We know, all I have to do is turn on the radio and I know what the value of gold is. I don't usually even know what the stones are, and then secondly, I have no idea what the relative value of these stones are. Okay, that's where I can't turn.
If chalupa is discarded because there's no consideration.
Chalipin, you mean?
Chalipin.
Chalipin. Chalipin or pin, either one.
Okay. But with the second one was documents. The tradition of using a document is not necessarily, I don't know, but I'm not sure that there'd be any consideration when there's a document.
That's correct. So you mean consideration in a legal term, in a legal sense?
Well, in the same way that you use it regarding the policy.
Correct. Thank you for bringing that the terminology up. In contract law, what you call this is consideration for the contract. There has to be something of value that is passed from the hands of one person to another that makes the contract a contract. The classic one you have here is Mayor Bloomberg's employment contract. Right? How much does the mayor get paid?
$1.
Right? The mayor gets paid $1. Why? Maybe you should get paid 50 cents. Or if you pay him a penny. Just think of all of this. Right? A dollar, we accept $1, but you have to have consideration for the contract. Something must pass from the hands of one person to the other in order for him to be an employee of the city of New York. Doesn't need the money, but you have to have it for $1. If we were to say we'll give him a quarter, that's like saying, you're worth $0.25. Don't let's get $1. It's a perfect example, I think, of the nature of chalipin. Right? It's consideration and not chalipin. Consideration, not chalipin. Did I answer your question?
Right.
I don't know the other direction, Bellamy. Want to ask it again?
Well, no, chalipin requires at least minimum consideration.
A chalipin or a kesef?
No, a chalipin.
Chalipin requires no value at all. Right.
So couldn't you make the same argument with documents?
Oh, that's right. Oh, that's a good point. Couldn't you make the same argument because the document isn't worth anything? It has no real value to it. That is why, if you remember the Rashi, in the Rashi to the Mishnah in the beginning says, when it mentions shtar, it says, even if the shtar is not worth a pruta. Because there what Rashi is trying to tell us, to tip us off a little early in the game, this will be discussed later on, is that a document written for the purpose is of significance because it is a written document and not because it's something of value. It is conceptually totally different. Okay, and therefore it need not have any value. If it had value, it would be like kesef. But because it need have no value, and because it is a permissible form of kiddushin, that means that conceptually there has to be one totally different possibility here, which is called the written document. And in this legal system, the written document has a certain validity, even if it has no value whatsoever. Okay, so it's a different idea.
But
Bia is different. Bia is not chalipin.
No, I know. In other words, value in the sense of Shabbat Sutra.
You could answer your own question. The assumption I tell it to you straight. The assumption is she wants the Bia, but she doesn't want something that's of no value. The Bia is a desirable thing. So the woman wants to have relations with her husband, right? And therefore, it's in its own category. And the Bia is considered central to marriage. That one of the central ideas of marriage, as we said the last time, is the derech, is the way of nature, which is Bia.
I think that the thing that's being discussed here is the definition of what value is. Okay, whether it's a monetary value or it's a document, in terms which is a document is just a communication of intent. And that has a certain value, whatever value means.
No, no, that's
okay,
correct.
And the Bira as well has a value, as you just
correct.
Said, whatever value means. So the central idea here is that there is value being communicated by all three things.
Very nice.
In fact, value also is ambiguous in that it changes. For example, a subprime mortgage, it changes. What's worth $500,000 one day is worth zero the next. mm-hmm. even though it's written down, mm-hmm. even though
people
and both sides agree.
Correct.
So, you know, what is that?
That's the
same thing.
Well, that's the point is well taken, that as long as we're dealing in a marketplace,
right.
The marketplace sets its own value, and that value can plummet in a minute.
That's
all that is true. Okay?
So this is a little off the subject, I think, but if you give somebody a piece of paper that says you give them $1 back, is that a Jewish thing? Is that $2?
I don't know what that is at all.
What? And there are penalties depending on
the penalty. You're not supposed to get knives without giving some money.
Let's say it's not an atonement. I've never heard of it before tonight. It could be a Jewish thing.
I remember my brother gave me some knives when I moved into my apartment. He said, you have to give me, pennies.
That's true. How do you like that? You learn something all the time. Very nice. Well, the seals that we have. Now, it's an interesting point. We have seals, and we have seals. Even from the biblical period, we now have in the Israel Museum. The seals are used to seal documents, so that the document is the key object. In the book of Jeremiah, for example, they discuss seals, and you always seal a document. So I don't know what its use was in Egypt, whether the seal itself was something that had, let's say, the validity of Kesar Shtar, one of these things. I just don't know what its purpose was. Okay?
Yes. In Yom Sudar, I just want to know the terminology. Is it in arranged purchase?
Kinyan Sudar? No, I would say the closest thing in English to a Kinyan Sudar is a handshake.
It's not that we rearrange the purchase.
No. It has nothing to do with prearrangement. It has to do with something that is essentially valueless, or potentially valueless, or almost valueless.
So I go into the transaction without knowing what will be the end result of the transaction.
That's not sudar. Sudar really means a sudar is a piece of cloth.
No, I'm looking at it from there.
From what? From his there?
Yeah.
No. It does not come from seder, it comes from sudar, meaning cloth. It comes from cloth. And the classic way of doing this was to take a piece of cloth, and the cloth then would be pulled. Okay? Yes?
Struggling with the rationale of the value of the kesa. I don't know if we'll come back to it.
It'll come in the next column.
Okay. Well, maybe it'll come up there. But the issue of whether or not that value is, because that's what's needed to make any sort of transaction, whether there's any relationship to the worth of the woman, because that seems like a really dangerous place to go. You certainly wouldn't want to exclude somebody from being able to marry if they were poor, because I don't think that would be good public policy or equitable. So, maybe these issues will come up, but this issue of saying it's degrading to the woman if it's a low amount of money for this other transaction raises up again this issue of what is the philosophical understanding of the concept, separate from the commercial tradition.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm trying to argue that it is somewhere in the middle, that it is on the one hand symbolic, almost entirely symbolic, but not entirely symbolic. What is entirely symbolic? Kinyan Sudar. Sudar is entirely symbolic. And yet, it is not really something of significant value, probably or partly because of the very argument that you just made, that in a way you're, it's bad public policy. You need to have something of minimal value in order to show that you are not really gaining value for value also. That's not a good policy to have, to make it seem as if you are giving something to someone that has any connection with their real value. Okay? So I think it's somewhere in between.
I think the example that you gave about offering Bloomberg a quarter instead of a dollar, when the usual route is a dollar a year man, and offering him a quarter is also an indication that he's not worth even a dollar. and that, I feel, is the same sort of thing.
Okay, good. Very good. Well, that could be. There could be that there are other problems with the Chaldean, but all I can say is that Marad didn't raise that problem. Okay? You're right. The Tosafot, in fact, raised that. That is raised in a Tosafot.
This is not relevant, but
how could that be?
If you make the Kiddushin with Bia, does the woman go home with her father anyway and refrain from relations with the husband for a year?
Well, ideally, you don't make the Kiddushin with Bia. Because, as I said to you, I think the real purpose of having Bia here, it's really twofold. One is because it happens. And the question is, what do you do once it happens? Do you recognize it or do you not recognize it as a form of marriage? So the answer to that is yes, it is recognized. There is a form of common law marriage which is recognized in the legal system. Not encouraged, but it is recognized. Okay? So I think that's part of it. The other part of it is that there is an analogy with Bia to other types of commercial transactions, too. And that is that Bia, as you'll see later on, is analogous to what's called chazakah. Chazakah is doing something that clearly shows that there has been a change. Okay? For example, you have in commercial law, if you purchase something, one way of acquiring it is lifting it up and walking out of the store with it. Okay? Hopefully, you know, in our system, you will have paid for it as well. But it could be that simply the transfer of the object means that you have acquired it, but that you still owe money on it. Okay? So that there is an activity, namely, of lifting up the object and bringing it into your own domain, which also has the possibility of acquisition. As I say, it may still be necessary for you to pay something, but it's yours. If it gets destroyed, let's say you have a fire, it's your object that got destroyed, not the department store's object that got destroyed. Okay, when you say to the department store, they come asking you for the money for that object, you say, oh, I'm sorry, it got destroyed in the fire. They say, no, your object got destroyed, not our object. Why? If it were simply a matter of payment, then you would be right. It would be the department stores because you hadn't paid yet. So we do acknowledge that there is a way of dealing with an object and bringing it into your own domain, which also creates acquisition. There are other forms of that in the law of real property in Jewish law. One of the ways that you do that is to walk around the field. Simply walking totally around the field creates the chazakah that it's your field. It's a publicly demonstrable activity. People see it. They know that this is a way that these things are done. And therefore, that is a way of acquiring something. sin of the lady, sexual intercourse can be seen in that as analogous to these kinds of sins, because it is a way of acting which is radically different than before the current state of affairs. So that can be understood as analogous to what's called chazaka. That's the technical term in Jewish law, chazaka. So that's another aspect of bia. Okay. Let's go on here. I want to be sure we finish this section. Because remember, we said so far that we had a number in the first part of the Mishnah, which excluded something. But we said that there was a number in the second part of the Mishnah that also excluded something. So, naturally, the Gemara wants to finish the thought and to find out what the number is in the second part of the Mishnah that is being excluded. The number in the second part of the Mishnah, what does that exclude? I remember what that number is. It said, and there are two ways that a woman gains her own. She acquires herself. Well, use the language. She koneat atzma. That she acquires herself. She koneat atzma. And those two ways were the get or the mitata bao. Either when she gets a get or the death of the husband. In which case, either of those, there's no more relationship there. Okay? The acquisition is over. The contract is superseded. So, if we said there are two ways, we could have just said what those two ways are. If we say there are two, that must have excluded a third. So, lima'ute chalitza. That comes to exclude chalitza. Chalitza. Now, remember what chalitza is. Chalitza is what you were referring to for a moment before. If a woman is married to a man, and the man dies, and leaves no children of any sex, and he has brothers, okay? The brothers are required to marry her, and she's required to marry one of the brothers.
Even if they live in different continents.
That doesn't make any difference. Oh, you have a big interest in this. Correct. That's a good point. Let's talk about that right now. Barry's great grandfather was Rabbi Yudelovich, who was the rabbi of the Eldridge Street Synagogue.
From 1918 to 1930.
Rabbi Yudelovich, just, what are the dates again?
1918 to 1930.
Okay. So just, that is the time of, right after World War One. Okay, right after World War One. There has been a tremendous amount of immigration before World War One. There is a tremendous amount of immigration after World War One.
It only stopped in 1924.
Exactly. So you have a Jewish community here that has roots on the other side. This is considerably before the Holocaust, so that you have a Jewish community that is alive and well and functioning in Europe, and a Jewish community that is new, functioning here in New York, that has rabbinic leadership, that is all part of this web of leadership. So, take an example here. A man dies in New York, and the woman is left here. The woman is left here, there's no issue, no children, and she has to marry the brother. That, however, became outlawed in Jewish law already in the time of the Talmud. The time of the Talmud forbids this, but what the Torah sets up is a procedure called chalitza. The procedure called chalitza is that the brother has to come and she takes off his shoe and she spits in front of him in order to humiliate him, because he is not willing to do what a brother should do. A brother should be willing to take his brother's wife. Now, again, this is prohibited. We don't allow this. We don't do it. But because the Torah sets up the laws of chalitza, we force the brother to give chalitza. The brother must give this woman chalitza. Till the woman gets chalitza, she can't get married, according to Jewish law. Okay? So, look, if the brother is on the west side, one is on the west side, and one is on the east side, this is not called a big deal. If in 1920, one brother is in Slutsk and one brother is in Manhattan on the Lower East Side, this is called a big deal. You don't have a fax machine. You don't have email. You don't have an airplane. To get on a boat to do something like this, it's a difficult thing to do.
Considered very costly.
It's dangerous. Right? Boats sink. They meet icebergs. I'll ask Newton them once in a while.
What do you have warmed up?
Okay. I'm afraid they're going to still. It's not going to help the situation. I'll have to warm up a lot first. It's going to cause the icebergs to catch, as they say. So his great great grandfather has a good idea. The idea is that we appoint an agent.
Yeah.
An agent should be appointed here in New York to perform, to do the chalitza. We'll get a letter from the other side. It'll be witnessed by witnesses, an appointment of agency. The letter will come here. We'll appoint the rabbi in New York. Somebody will be the agent of the person on the other side so the woman can get married. So isn't that a good idea? It's a very good idea. It was a terrific idea.
When they found a way with the Talmud to do it and everything. However, the Orthodox rabbis of the era, both here in America and in Europe, cursed out my great-grandfather.
Uh-huh.
And
his name was Mudd.
The Mudd and Mudd family left Orthodoxy.
It's a very interesting chapter of New York Jewish history, which Gary is now researching because he found out he had a special connection. And he didn't realize it at one point, but now he realizes the entire story. The Rabbi's Yeshiva University basically kicked him out.
He was one of the first leaders of the Yeshiva University, and they literally turned on him.
And then there's Barry has, and he shared with me some of the literature here, where some of the rabbis come to his support.
Right.
Because this is a perfectly reasonable thing. They were liberal. It's not what you and I would call liberal.
Right.
Not exactly.
He was very Orthodox, my great-grandfather.
I mean, all these people are people that you and I would look at and we would say, oh, a bunch of black hats. But this is a different world. This is a different world in which they were living. So this is the issue of chalitza. This is the issue of chalitza. And according to the law, chalitza to this day is an issue. If it becomes relevant, we have to make sure that there is chalitza in order to be able to perform a marriage. Okay? Wait, let's go on. I'm running out of time, okay? So, then Mishnah came to tell us that there are two ways to dissolve the marriage, and a woman can gain back her own independence two ways. What does that exclude? It excludes the method of chalitza. It excludes the method of chalitza. So, kedatachanina, lest you would have thought, te dekal v'chomer mi'evama. Maybe we should be able to use the method of chalitza. Logically, we'll make the following argument. In the case of the yivama, the woman who is in this difficult position, she can't get out of that position with a get. Right? A get doesn't help her. A get doesn't help her. She has to have chalitza. In that case, ma yivama she'ena yotza beget, a yivama who doesn't need a get, yotza bechalitza. that lady can be freed with the activity of chalitza, the symbolic actions of chalitza, the woman who is in a more difficult legal position, namely the woman who has to have a get, Eino din, isn't it logical? Isn't it logical that that woman should also be able to gain her freedom through chalitza? Kamashmalan, therefore, the Mishnah comes and teaches us, no, that's not logical. There are only two ways that she can gain her own freedom. The one is a get, and the second one is the death of the husband. So lest you would have thought that there was a third method, and that third method you would have thought because it was logical. There is not such a third method. There are only two, and therefore the Mishnah has to say two. Okay? Question? Yes.
Second half gets me back to Kesef. because I think Kesef is written backwards. Because if I were writing it, I would be writing there's one way in which a woman can take a man, which is to accept his Kesef. And there are two ways in which a man can take a woman, which is the other two ways. Or, because it just seems, because if the woman's acceptance of that ring, that's the key to that transaction, it's not the offer.
Well, the point that we learned before was that the reason that it's written the way it is written is in order to convey to us that she has to agree to it. Okay? And that both parties have to be party to this. You cannot force anybody, you cannot force him, you cannot force her into this transaction. Both of them have to agree to the nature of the transaction.
Right, but the formulation starts with the man taking.
No, it says, Isha Miknet. The woman is acquired. It's in the passive tense. That doesn't say a man acquires. The second chapter said, Ha'ish Mekadesh, the man performs the kiddushin. The first chapter says, Ha'isha Miknet, the woman is acquired, in order to emphasize to us the importance of her agreement to what she is getting involved in. Okay? Okay, wait, let's just go one more little piece here. Because now the Gemara says, the Ema Achinami, Gemara finally says, this is not such a bad idea, the Chalitza possibility. You don't like it, but maybe it's not a bad idea. Okay? Amakra, therefore scripture says, Sefer Kritut. When it talks about a get, it talks about a bill of divorcement. A bill, a sefer, a book literally, of Kritut, of cutting off. Alright? Sefer Kritut ve'en davar acher korta. A book correct cuts. A book cuts, namely a get cuts. A get can cut off this tie between the two of them, and that's exclusive. Nothing else. There's only one method of cutting the tie if the two people are still alive, and that is the Sefer Kritut, what we come to eventually call the get. And that is exclusive, and that is the force of the word korate or kritut. Okay? Finish.
What is that one?
I was going to ask if the relative living in Europe could appoint the shaliach that's going to the United States anyway to do this chalitza for him.
The issue in Jewish law is whether this is a permissible, certain things you can't appoint an agent to do. That's the issue.
At least it seems so personal.
Let me just tell you the classic issue that is raised in this context. We read that there are three forms of kiddushin: kesef, shtar, and bia. How about appointing an agent to do your kiddushin? Have an agent. I appoint so and so my agent to give this woman the money on my behalf.
Abraham did
it. That's him, son. I star. I appoint you to write a document to be witnessed on my behalf. Okay. I appoint you to have sex with this woman. You see, there's a problem? There's a problem. Yeah. Okay, good.
No, the issue of Aguna, there are people that have made arguments and appointed him certain text to try to support that. Where did that come from? Is it from...
The Aguna is the case now of a woman who is, she's married. We don't have, she doesn't have a get to end the marriage. And the problem is either she can't get a get because he won't give her the get. That happens. And the Torah says she has to have a get or else she's married. Or we don't know whether he's alive or not. That's the other possibility. So the Aguna is actually somewhat different, but it's not totally different.
But the arguments that people that are trying to help the Aguna, is it coming from here or from
It depends on how they try to help the Aguna. And because one of the classic ways of helping the Aguna is to retroactively annul the marriage. Correct.
But this
text
that they've pointed to, and I don't know exactly
where it's from. It's not from here. Very good. To be continued in 2 weeks.
Nora, you where did this
come from? The terminology was confusing me in terms of barter and gift.